finds has led to planned gifts which help WLRN sustain and grow. Through your will or estate plan, you can name Friends of WLRN as the beneficiary of your estate or a portion of it, providing an enduring legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977.
And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Monday edition. Well, we now turn to Indiana University law professor and constitutional scholar David Orentlicker. He's taught at both Princeton and University of Chicago law schools. He was a three-term state legislator, and he'll explain the premise behind his book, Two Presidents Are Better Than One: The Case for a Bipartisan Executive Branch. And he joins us from Indianapolis. Welcome to you, Professor.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Welcome, Professor. Just considering the gridlock in our political system today, caused by just the intransigence of members of Congress, why wouldn't two presidents only make for more of the same? Wouldn't they just bring their partisanship to the White House?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's kind of counterintuitive, but here's the problem. Right now, all the incentives in Washington favor conflict, and what drives it most is the what I call the imperial presidency. It's not my term. Actually, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. coined it in the 1970s. But what's happened over the past 75 years is more and more of the national government's power has moved from Congress, where the framers rested it, over to the executive branch. And we have all these administrative agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency that the president oversees and that writes all the rules and regulations that come out of the national government. And presidents use executive orders and signing statements and a lot of other devices to exercise pretty broad control over a policy now. And we see it especially in foreign policy. You know, a good example, last week the Wall Street Journal had a front page article about members of Congress urging the president to intervene in Syria. And wait, the Constitution gives Congress the authority to decide when we get involved with wars and other military interventions, and yet Congress is calling on the president to make the decision. So what's happened is all this power has moved to the White House, and every 4 years, we have a winner-take-all election for the presidency and to decide who gets to exercise all that power. So, of course, people are going to fight, as they do, tooth and nail to win the election, and then we get the permanent campaign. Over the next 4 years, you know, now with a Democratic president, Democrats in Congress line up behind the president because they want him to be successful so that the Democrats can retain the White House, and Republicans, instinctively, their main strategy is to oppose whatever Obama proposes. They oppose so that they can discredit him and retain and regain the White House. So that's the problem. The incentives, it's all this battle over control of power, and as long as we have that one party control, we're going to have conflict. So the way to diffuse it is to say, instead of allowing you guys to fight over power, we're going to require you to share it. And no matter what you do, there's no maneuvering or jockeying or backstabbing that'll get you more power. And once you change the incentives, then people will start working together. And because here's what's going to – now you've got two presidents from two parties. Why wouldn't they fight? Because what presidents care most about is their legacy. They want to go down in the pantheon of greats like Roosevelt, FDR, and Lincoln, and George Washington. And the prospect of not having a record of achievement, because that's what would happen if they fought, would be unacceptable. And as I say, their drive to go to have be respected in the history books, that's what would lead them to cooperate with each other.
I was just thinking that Abraham Lincoln's chief opponent in his first run for the presidency before the Civil War was John Breckinridge. Now, if this principle were in place then, John Breckinridge, who turned to the Confederacy and was a Confederate general, we would have had a Confederate and a union supporter in the White House at once?
Yeah, you know that.
I mean, that goes back a lot of years, I know.
But. Yeah, no, it's interesting. What you know, you have to judge a lot of you know, what would have happened if George W. Bush had shared the White House with Al Gore. I'm quite confident we wouldn't have gone into Iraq. On the other hand, if Thomas Jefferson had shared the White House with John Adams, I'm very confident we would have still had the Louisiana Purchase because John Adams was on record supporting it. It's much more complicated to look at the history, the Civil War and the slavery question, because that's a question that spanned, a problem that started from the very beginning of our country. So yes, Lincoln would have had to share with Breckinridge or Douglas. Douglas got more of the popular vote, Breckinridge more of the electoral vote. But in the years leading up to the White House, we would have had shared governance. And we may have very well, if the North and South had shared power in all those years, we might have gotten a much better reconciliation, because it couldn't have been any worse. I mean, the 750,000 dead and the many more wounded, the devastation that resulted from the Civil War, and then the Reconstruction period and Jim Crow, it's just hard to imagine it would have been any worse than it actually played out. And I think with shared governance, maybe we would have found a solution well before 1860.
You talk about legacy. The legacy factor is an impetus to cooperation among the two executives. But going back to that, but what one might consider a legacy item, the other might see as a political issue. I mean, if we just look at health care, the environment, immigration, how would that work?
Well, it does seem, because when you listen to them talk, that it seems like, how could they ever find common ground? They seem to have such different visions. But, and this is where I draw on my experience in 6 years in the legislature, a lot of this posturing is for electoral purposes. If you don't stake out very different positions, then why will the voters care? When you think about your winning at elections, you have to draw sharp distinctions. But when it comes to governing, then it's a different story. And healthcare is a good example, because we had a Republican, Mitt Romney, as governor of Massachusetts, who pioneered healthcare reform for Massachusetts. And we had a Democratic president, Barack Obama, doing it in Washington. And they both came up with the exact same healthcare plan. And we're looking at immigration now. It's not that there's not common ground, that Republicans and Democrats can't come up with a proposal that's acceptable to both sides. What's preventing them from doing it is the sort of political calculation of how will this affect us in November 2014. If you could take that off the table, we'd have an immigration bill that would be signed very quickly. And now and then you'll hear elected officials acknowledge it. I think just a week or two ago, Senator Toomey from Pennsylvania, I forget if it was immigration or gun control, but he said, you know, if this proposal comes out with Barack Obama's signature on it, there's no way we're going to support it, because it's a Democratic proposal.
Mm. At the beginning of the country and during the Articles of Confederation and that, or at the beginning of the Constitution, the vice president was always the second highest vote getter, and that didn't work out very well.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting, because you're right. We have had experience with saying the top two vote-getters would go to Washington, and in my proposal, the top two vote-getters, instead of being president and vice president, would be equal presidents, 50-50. It didn't work out, but not the reason why they discarded it was not because, you know, when Thomas Jefferson served as vice president under John Adams and they were from different parties, it broke down because of the different parties. What happened was in 1800, we had the tie between Jefferson and his vice presidential candidate, Aaron Burr. As one of the members of the Electoral College, each had two votes, and one of them was supposed to vote only once, so that you wouldn't have a tie between the president and vice president, but somebody made a mistake, and it went into the House, and it was a mess. So because of the problem with ties, that's why we had the 12th Amendment to eliminate it. But the other point is that's important about it is, I agree, it would not work to have people from different parties if they didn't have equal power. as long as there was a dominant member of the pair, it would break down. That's absolutely right. The only way this will work, the only way, as I said, you want to give people incentives to work together, and the only way they'll have incentives to work together rather than fight is if they understand that no matter what they do, it's a 50-50 relationship during their 4 years, and they can't say, well, maybe the next election I'll gain the upper hand. As long as they understand it's always going to be 50-50, that's what will drive them to cooperate. Because if there's ever an opportunity to gain the upper hand, yes, then they'll fight. I don't doubt that at all.
But just thinking about some things like practically, like presidential nominees to the Supreme Court, what if they couldn't agree on somebody? It just seems like it would lead to even more conflict. What if they never could agree on a nominee?
No, they would have to agree. You're absolutely right. If, at least under my proposal, what I do say is no action could be taken unless both agreed. But I think what would happen is, again, it's not in their interest to leave these Supreme Court positions unfilled, because if they don't fill them, then their successors will fill them. And again, it's their successor's legacy, not their legacy. So what I think we would see is the two of them agreeing on, centrist, moderate nominees instead of pushing for conservative or liberal nominees. And then the other thing is, so now if you have these bipartisan nominees coming to Congress, there's no political incentive to filibuster or otherwise try to delay. The New York Times just in the past couple of days had a front page article about how the mounting delays, both for executive branch nominees and judicial nominees, because Republicans don't want to approve Obama appointee nominees, that would disappear, and all these positions would get filled so much more quickly, and we wouldn't have these vacant judgeships, and we wouldn't have these vacant executive branch positions, and I think the government would function much more effectively if both parties had to agree on who's going to fill these positions.
Well, we'll get back to more of this. We're speaking with Professor David Orentlicker. He's a professor of law at Indiana University School of Law. And the name of the book is Two Presidents Are Better Than One. On today's Topical Currents, a short break, and we'll come back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We're funded by listeners like you and by a grant from Damian Pardo, Vice President and Financial Advisor at the Pardo Group at Morgan Stanley in Aventura, a proud supporter of WLRN. Details at 305-466-4806, Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC, member SIPC.
Our Kids, the lead foster care agency for Miami-Dade and the Keys, reminds everyone that May is Foster Care Awareness Month. While Our Kids has dramatically reduced the number of children who enter the foster care system each year, there are still hundreds of children who need people in our community to open their homes to help mentor and care for the most vulnerable among us. You can join the thousands who have known the joys of fostering a child by becoming a foster parent. Details at 855-786-KIDS, funded by Our Kids and the Florida Department of Children and Families.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and also David Orentlicker. His book is Two Presidents Are Better Than One. If you'd like to join in with a comment or question, could you picture two presidents of different parties in the White House? Give us a call, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, it's radio@WLRN.org. Professor, what would you propose if one of these presidents dies in office?
Yeah, you would have to have two vice presidential nominees for this reason, because if the Democratic president died, you'd want to have the vice president from the Democratic side or a Republican, then you want to have a Republican succeeding, so you'd still maintain the bipartisan balance. And I want to also add that third party candidates could also serve. It's the top two vote getters, so it's not that I would reserve it just for Democrats and Republicans, it would be important to make sure third-party candidates could also compete. And one of the virtues is it's much easier to run second than first. Right now, under our current system, when you like a third-party candidate, you're afraid that you're just going to help the person your last choice if Ralph Nader voters took away votes from Al Gore, it would have just made it even more certain that George W. Bush would win. So Nader supporters, instead of risking their least desirable outcome, voted for Al Gore. With two people going to the White House, then if you're an Ralph Nader supporter, you can say, well, even if I bring down Al Gore, it just means that Al Gore will run a more distant second to George W. Bush. But if Nader doesn't run second, Al Gore will still go into the White House. So it makes it more feasible for third-party candidates. But other than having a vice president and a small personal staff for each of the two presidents, they would have a single shared nominee, whether it's the Secretary of Defense or a Supreme Court nominee. And again, that would be important to be sure that we get bipartisan nominees who reflect the views of all of us, not just, the problem is it's so unrepresentative when you have a president from one party. As I said earlier, we've given the president all this control over the policymaking power of our country, and it's one person from one party. George Washington, to his credit, said, I represent everybody, not just people from one state or one political party. I see the entire country as my constituency, and that's what the framers expected our presidents to do. But they don't. They really represent their party, and that means that after every election, half the public feels like they don't have a voice in the White House, and that's not what a democracy is supposed to be about.
So let's say there's a constitutional amendment which would implement that. I think that'd be a pretty tough sled, but the first time it's implemented and there's a landslide presidential election, 55 to 45, the 55% vote getter is going to feel pretty cheated. The votes that the 45%er got mean actually more than the 55%.
Well, yeah, what about that? That's a good point. It's never going to be 50-50 on the vote. You're right, it's going to be 55-45 or some other difference. And so, yeah, there is going to be a small unfairness, but it pales compared to the level of unfairness we have today, because right now we have a president, Barack Obama, who got 52 or 53% of the vote, somewhere in that range. It was, 51, 52, but whatever it was, he's got 100% of the power based on just over 50% of the vote. And so one thing I look back is we've had a stable two-party system since about 1840, and almost all the presidents get a little bit above 50% or below 50%. Many of them get below 50%. George W. Bush, Bill Clinton never reached 50%. Harry Truman and so on, sometimes because of third-party candidates, sometimes because Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush. Only three presidents, the high water mark since 1840 is about 61% of the vote, and only three presidents have reached that high water mark. But even when it's 60-40, again, 60 is 20% more than 40, but 60% is 40% away from 100%, and so the unfairness is much greater when we give all the power to one person. But the important point that you're kind of highlighting here is that my proposal only works as long as it's relatively balanced between the two parties. If it ever got where one party was getting 2/3 or 3/4 of the support, then that would be unfair to give both parties equal representation. But as I say, because it's been so stable since 1840, I don't think that would be a problem.
Just this morning, I don't know if you heard the interview with former Republican Senator Olympia Snowe, who said, because she wrote a book, she left the Senate because they couldn't get anything accomplished. And she said it wasn't the institution of the Senate that was flawed, it was the members of the Senate. So how would this change with two presidents? I don't see how.
You know, I've seen the reports, the books, and I hadn't heard that, so I appreciate you bringing that up. Yeah, I'm going to have to disagree with her, and this is where I'm very Madisonian. You know, James Madison's view when he was working and proposing the different structures, designs for our government was that it's not necessarily the kinds of people and whether they're, you could say we just have to elect the right people. But I don't think that's right. And again, my experience as a state legislator confirms this. It's really the system drives behavior. You know, I campaign like most people saying I'm going to be bipartisan. I'm going to reach across the aisle and support, if they're good ideas, that's what will matter, not whether they're Democratic or Republican ideas. But the way you get in there and you see how the system really drives people to be partisan, even if they come in planning to be bipartisan. It's not. I don't think we somehow select when we elect for the most partisan people. I think it's the system, and we're never going to get, collegial behavior unless we give incentives for collegial behavior. And as I say, right now, the incentives are for partisan conflict. And so, we could elect 535 Olympia Snows, and I think we'd still end up with partisan conflict.
Let's take a couple of phone calls. This is Ken. He's in Miami. Hi.
I just have a question about what I get from the author is he's saying that the problem with laws in the country are they're proposed by the president, but the structure is Congress makes the laws, the executive branch enforces them, and the judicial branch reviews them. So why wouldn't you split the Senate 50-50 and have whoever's in the White House be the tiebreaker? And that would, to me, that would breed more bipartisanism than having a half dozen senators from small states controlling the interests of the country.
Yeah, that's a good question. And as Kenneth has described it, it's exactly right. The original plan was that Congress would legislate, would make the policy decisions, and then the president, the executive branch, the president should execute it and just implement the policy. And you're right, if that's the way the system worked, we wouldn't have to worry about whether we have one president from one party or two presidents from two parties, because we'd have to worry about partisan balance in Congress. But because so much power has been transferred, and Congress has turned it over willingly, and that's where Madison was wrong. He thought the legislative branch, all branches, would jealously guard their power, and it would be the, pitting ambition against ambition. That's what would keep the government in check. But instead of jealously guarding its power, Congress has handed it over, on a silver platter to the White House, and presidents have run with it and done other things to amplify the transfers. So that's the problem. Presidents are no longer executors of policy. They're makers of policy. And because all that policy is being made in the White House, you can't rely on, reforming Congress to fix things as long as that power is in the White House. And that takes to another problem I talk about in the book. When you have policy being made by one person who necessarily has one perspective, you're just not going to get optimal decision making. There's a good reason why we say two heads are better than one, and economists and psychologists and other researchers have studied decision, who makes better decisions, single people, single decisive people, or groups. And groups do a better job because you want people coming with different perspectives and having to reconcile those differences. And that's why the framers said we want Congress to make policy, because we know we're going to get people from different parts of the country and different philosophical perspectives, and they're going to have to reach compromises that will get us better policy than having just one side decide everything.
But surely presidents don't act alone. I mean, they have advisors, they have cabinet members.
Yes, they do. That's a good point. Presidents don't decide alone. They have their staff and their cabinets, and so they'll get many of the benefits of group decision making. But in the end, it's their decision. And there are studies that have looked at this too, that it's not enough to rely on advisors because you get groupthink problems. There's a big difference when you have one person who's got advisors who are inclined to reinforce the decision-maker, the president's inclinations, and sharing decision-making with somebody who's inclined to challenge your inclinations. An example I like to use is take the Supreme Court. We've got nine people with very different perspectives, and they have to come to some decision as a group. If you had one justice with eight advisors, eight very good law clerks you'd get very different decisions, because those clerks, even though they'd be playing devil's advocate and all that, it still would be driven by the single justice's perspective. And so you can't really get the benefits of different perspectives when you have advisors. It's funny, there's even a study that's looked at this when they've asked people to play devil's advocate in these simulated, scenarios, and they find that unless the devil's advocates truly believe in the devil's advocate position, they're not as effective in their deliberations
right.
with the person who's got to make the decision.
We're speaking with Professor David Arntlicher of the University of Indiana University School of Law. The name of the book is Two Presidents Are Better Than One. We'll take a short break on Topical Currents, come back and take some emails and some more calls. Stay with us.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. Thanks so much for being with us today. Quick look at weather. Mostly cloudy skies, 86 degrees, 40% chance of thunderstorms this afternoon.
Miami Children's Chorus showcases the diversity and artistic excellence of our South Florida youth in Let the Children Sing. This program marks the completion of the MCC 2012-2013 season and will feature all three MCC ensembles performing traditional and contemporary multicultural choral works in English, Spanish, Shona, French, and Czech. Sunday, May 19th, 4 p.m., First United Methodist Church of Coral Gables. Details at 305-662-7494 or miamichildrenschorus.org.
For years, working in healthcare in South Florida meant job security and a good paycheck, but job growth has slowed in the industry recently. I'm Tom Hudson. Join us tonight at 7 for the Sunshine Economy, Diagnosis Healthcare in South Florida, made possible by Kaufman, Rossin & Company.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor David Arntlicher were discussing his book, Two Presidents Are Better Than One. David, is there a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Yeah, if they go to, this is published by New York University Press, so if they go to nyupress.org and search for Two Presidents or search Arntlicher, the book will pop up.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, also email. That's radio@wlrn.org.
And we have an emailer. Fritz says, isn't the real problem that elected representatives get bought off by special interests and then ignore the will of the voters? Gun control and single-payer health care being blatant examples. This could be solved by internet-based direct democracy.
Well, there's no question. Fritz is absolutely right that the influence of special interests is tremendous, and it's hard to know exactly how you solve that problem. I will say one of the advantages of having a bipartisan executive is it does reduce the incentive for corporate donations, because right now they know the difference between electing a Democratic or Republican president is huge, and that's why they're willing to spend hundreds of millions, now billions of dollars. But if they know they're going to get a Democrat and Republican, or if it's a third-party candidate, you're still going to get somebody from the right and somebody from the left. If you know it's going to be balanced, then it's not going to matter so much exactly who gets elected, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama as a Democrat or John McCain and Mitt Romney on the Republican side. Those differences are just much smaller than the differences between a Mitt Romney and a Barack Obama. So you will reduce the incentive for people to dump all this money into the election campaigns. That said, they're still going to lobby Congress. They're still going to lobby the executive branch, and it is very hard. But at least what you get is that because the presidents will not be so dependent on special interests for getting elected, it'll be a little easier for them to promote the public good. Turning to direct democracy, it works in a small town, in the New Hampshire town meetings, but when you get to a country as large as the United States, there's a good reason why we have a representative government, that you just can't have deliberations with 300 million people. I wish it would work that way, but...
Right.
Professor, under this plan, it certainly is human nature when you're on equal footing in a place of power that skullduggery begins. And one president, President Bonnie and President David, and Bonnie decides that she wants to get control of the military, and it seems like it opened the door for a coup or some other kind of skullduggery.
Yeah, that's a good question. Why, you're right, because...
I mean, if you look at history, it's happened all the time.
Yeah, and so one of the things I do in the book is look at game theory, which is a study of strategic behavior, and game theorists look at what leads people in these kinds of relationships to cooperate and what leads them to defect, to not fight with each other. And so certain elements of relationships foster cooperation and certain foster defection. And so as I've thought about how you would structure this, I've tried to include the elements of cooperative relationships, and a few of them are important. One is that you want to have ongoing relationships where people have to deal with each other multiple times. Because yes, if you've got a one-shot relationship, you're only going to deal with them once. There's going to be a lot of efforts to gain the maximum. Whereas if you're going to deal with somebody over and over, then if you screw them now, they can retaliate, and you don't want that to happen. So the example I use, I have a pretty good relationship with the guy, Pat, who services my car, because he knows I'm going to be back, for my oil change and my tire rotation and any other repairs. He knows he's going to see me at least four times a year, and so he's pretty nice to me. Whereas when I go to buy a car, they don't expect to ever see me back, and so they're trying to get whatever they can out of me. So having an ongoing relationship where you're making a lot of decisions together, as I say, if you engage in skullduggery today, your partner is going to retaliate tomorrow, and that'll just defeat your desire to leave a legacy. And the other things that when you have a lot of, it's not only ongoing long term, but frequent. The more frequent the decisions that you have to make together, and presidents are going to have to make decisions. If you had two presidents on a daily basis, and the other thing that is most critical, the fact that they would be balanced, that the 50-50 balance of power would discourage any, as they start to think, well, should I do any, engage in some skullduggery, then they would quickly realize, no, I mean, this is a 50-50 relationship, and, the tit for tat, whatever, they can retaliate, and if I want them to cooperate with me, I've got to cooperate with them.
What did you use for your model, Professor? Where has power sharing been successful in history? The Roman Republic, when they had two consuls?
Well, it's interesting because the Roman Republic has a bad reputation, and Alexander Hamilton, when he wrote about why we should have a single president in the Federalist Papers, used that as an example of failed shared leadership. But when you actually go back and look at the historical record, it actually worked pretty well. They had the ancient Rome, they started with a monarchy, and people, when they dumped the monarchy, they did not want to have an executive who would have the powers of a king. They had been through that, and so that was one of their reasons why they had the two consuls, to avoid concentration of power in one person. And in fact, Rome flourished in the Rome Republic for 400 years, which is a pretty good track record. It started to break down, so the last 100 years of the 500-year run wasn't so good, and there was eventually they got involved into the Roman Empire. But if the people looked at it, it wasn't because they had shared leadership. What really led to the breakdown was that they, as they were conquering more and more lands and trying to assimilate these different, you know, cult communities, it, that's where they ran into trouble, and so they ended up with their empire. But you know, their empire was a dictatorship, so that's hardly a model we would want to emulate. The modern example I like is Switzerland, because Switzerland, they faced the difficulties of trying to bring together, you know, they have French and German and Italian and their Romance communities, so they had to bring very diverse communities into one country. And they also had Protestant Catholic communities, and they had a civil war in the 19th century, just like we did. Theirs was on religious grounds, and it was a smaller civil war, but you know, wars are not good when... and so what they did in the wake of their civil war is to adopt their current constitution, and one of the things that they... The critical part of their constitution is the power sharing, both in the legislature and in the executive branch. And then what they do in their executive branch is they have... It's a seven-member executive branch, and they make sure that all the major parties are represented. And very importantly, they also, the two things, one is the broad representation of the major parties, and two, that they operate on a basis of consensus, that they don't all take majority votes except in exceptional circumstances. As a, the general principle is we work by consensus, that everybody has to agree. And it's worked pretty well.
And we'll go back to our callers. This listener, this is Sam and Kendall. Hi.
Good afternoon, Joseph. I applaud you for having this professor on. And with all due respect, I have little respect for his proposition. I think it's horse feathers. If you want to talk about imbalance in the federal government, it's not the presidency where, yes, there may be a 55-45, we call a landslide split. The real split and the real problem is the Senate. When the Constitution and the country was founded, the ratio between the small states and the large states population-wise was 13 to 1. It is now on the nature of 68 to 1. Between that, I mean, that out-of-balance ratio and the abuse of the filibuster, you now have 41 senators representing less than 11% of the population, can in principle can block action supported by 59 senators representing more than 89% of the population. To me, that's where the problem is, and that's where we have to talk about, if we're going to change the Constitution, we have to address the population imbalance and representation in the Senate.
Professor?
Well, that is a problem, there's no doubt about it, but the idea that that is the central problem, that's just not accurate. You know, where partisan conflict was at its greatest in recent years is, has been in the House. You know, remember the Reagan, the Republican Revolution that Newt Gingrich led to topple Tom Foley and lead, you know, end the decades-long control by Democrats in the House. And why it came out of the House rather than the Senate was because in the House, where there's no filibuster, the majority, whether it's a 51% majority or 56% majority, has a lock. They control all the committees. They control all the votes as long as they line up their voters, because they can, they, you know, they win. They have a vote 210 to 208. That's all they need. Whereas in the Senate, where the majority has to worry about the filibuster, the senator, the majority has to work with the minority, and you tend to find. Look, healthcare reform fared much better in the Senate than it did in the House. Yes, the filibuster can gum up things, but that's just a symptom of the problems that we've got. This, you know, the presidential power driving conflict, and so the filibuster is a manifestation of it. But it's a symptom; it's not a cause. And the virtue of the filibuster, frankly, is that it doesn't allow the majority to ignore the minority. You know, the alternative to letting 40% block the majority is to let the majority ignore the 40% minority, and everybody ought to have a voice. Just because you lose one election in November shouldn't mean that for 4 years, for, you know, 1,300 days and thousands of decisions that you have no voice. That to me is, as I say, profoundly undemocratic.
We're speaking with Professor David Orentlicker of Indiana University School of Law, and the name of his book is Two Presidents Are Better Than One, The Case for a Bipartisan Executive Branch. One more short break on Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
This is 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM, back in just a moment.
The Truman Legacy Symposium explores the impact of Harry S. Truman's presidency on Friday and Saturday, May 17th and 18th. Speakers include former chair of the House Armed Services Committee, Ike Skelton, Clifton Truman Daniel, and Ken Heckler, a member of Truman's staff, among others. It starts Friday evening, May 17th at the Little White House and concludes Saturday afternoon, May 18th at the Marriott Key West Beachside Hotel. Details at TrumanSymposium.com. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
Join us for Tuesday's Topical Currents when we visit with University of Notre Dame Professor of New Testament and Early Christianity, Candida Moss. She's written The Myth of Persecution, which studies the age of martyrs over the past 2,000 years, beginning with the Roman execution of Jesus. Tradition maintains that during Christianity's first 300 years, its followers were mercilessly persecuted. Were they? Learn more on Topical Currents Tuesday at 1 o'clock.
And we return 48 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's Topical Currents on WLRN. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, and constitutional scholar and law professor David Orentlicker. His book is called Two Presidents Are Better Than One. David, what about the situation where a commander-in-chief has to be making really tough decisions? It makes me think about if they had Osama bin Laden cornered and somebody had to make the decision, yes, we go, or no, we don't. What if the presidents disagree?
Yeah, you're right. They would have to agree to take action. So sort of the default is no action. Each of them would have a veto. There's no question about that. Even actually in those kinds of most pressing kinds of decisions, what, you know, the most severe national security threat, what would happen? And there are a few reasons why I'm pretty comfortable with that. One is we know that in the face of those kinds of threats, people close ranks, that you don't tend to see people, you know, the elected officials politicizing national security threats, and they do put those aside and say, what's best for the country? And you know, we have examples from other countries where you have group decision making in the face of national security threats, and it works fine. Israel is an example I like to use because they face national security threats on a regular basis. They have a multi-person cabinet, and then they also have a smaller national security cabinet, and so they don't respond to attacks or other military threats until they've convened and made a group decision. The other thing that's important to remember is sometimes is you're worse off when you have a single person responding and, you know, to unexpected international developments. And the example I like to use to illustrate that is during the 2008 presidential campaign, in August of 2008, Georgia and Russia had their little war. And when it broke out, John McCain immediately denounced Russia for its aggression. Barack Obama waited because he wanted to get more information, and rightly so, because as more information came out, it turned out that Georgia also was at fault, that there was plenty of fault to go around, and just to pick on one country and blame turned out to be the wrong response. So sometimes, you know, if you make a bad decision in the face of unexpected events, it can make things far worse. And by having two people to have to talk things over and think about it a little bit, we'll be better off. And when it's an obvious threat where a missile's on its way, there won't be any need to deliberate, and they'll make a decision very quickly.
We have an emailer. Stephen says, given that the Republicans feel the need to run to the extreme right in fear of the Tea Party, wouldn't this indicate the danger that presidential candidates from both parties might be from the far fringes and there would be less chance of cooperation?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. What would happen if you knew that, you know, absent a strong third-party candidate, your nominee will go to the White House? Does that encourage both parties to nominate somebody on the extremes? And that's one possible outcome. The other scenario that you could imagine is what would happen is, since elections would be decided in the primaries rather than in November, then each side would say, the voters now, there are a lot of voters who don't vote in the primaries. They think, you know, I'll have my say in November. So they wait till November, and then they have their say. If the presidential election is going to be decided in the primaries, all those voters will realize, boy, I better vote in the primaries if I'm going to have a say. And right now, the turnouts are surprisingly small. Like the Iowa caucus, for example, which is such a pivotal process, they don't even get 20% of eligible voters. It's usually more like in the 15% range. I think they got up to 18% in 2008. So you would drive all these November more moderate voters into the primary polls, and that might actually moderate the polls. The other thing I think that's important is the reason why I think the Tea Party matters is because it's not a coincidence that the Tea Party emerged in the wake of the 2008 presidential election, because you had 47% of the public, or 46%, I think McCain got 46%, who felt that they had no voice in the White House. So not all of them were extreme Tea Partiers, but they were disempowered. And when you deny people a voice in their government, they are going to be receptive to extremists. In a bipartisan executive where most people will feel like they have a voice, then the extremists, there's just not a pool, a mass of disaffected voters that they can appeal to. Mm-hmm. So for all those reasons, I'm not worried. And then the final reason, of course, is even if you put extremists, even if you put Nancy Pelosi and Eric Cantor together, they will want their legacy, and they will work together. And you look at John Boehner and Barack Obama, the two of them alone can actually work pretty well together. It's when John Boehner has to go back to his caucus,
right,
where he's got people there who are driven by partisan considerations and do have incentives to fight. Boehner's worried about his legacy as Speaker, but his colleagues aren't at that point yet, and that's where he has trouble selling his deals. But Boehner and Obama, they work together pretty well.
I don't know about Eric Cantor and Nancy Pelosi working together. But I was going to ask you, Professor, what was your you were a three-term Indiana state representative. What was that like? Were you effective?
Yeah. I look back on those days, and, you always want to make huge changes, but, I was able to find common ground on things like health care reform and we had a serious problem with child abuse, and that's not a Democratic or Republican issue. It's protecting kids from being abused, and there was a Republican senator who I could work with and to get legislation through. But the other thing what led me to the proposal of this book I saw was that a lot of it was driven by instead of the president, it was the governor, and I saw when the governor would have an initiative, that Democrats whose districts their voters would have liked the idea, but because it was a Republican governor, many of these Democrats would vote against it. And I saw Republicans whose districts would be against the proposal support it nevertheless because it was a Republican governor. And so it's on a smaller scale at the state level, but it's there nevertheless, and it makes it harder. So sometimes you can find common ground, but the incentives for partisan fighting would blocked a lot of good things. We could always have done more than.
Well, we're just about running out of time. David Orentlicker, his book is Two Presidents Are Better Than One. He's a Indiana University law professor and constitutional scholar, and he's got his book Two Presidents Are Better Than One: The Case for a Bipartisan Executive Branch. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. You can always find free audio archives and downloads of programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is with Notre Dame religion professor Candida Moss about her controversial book, The Myth of Persecution, which discusses the history of martyrdom in Christianity. And today's calendar, on this day in 1912, 101 years ago, the birth of radio guru and author Studs Terkel in New York, The Good War, Working Hard Times. He appeared in the baseball movie Eight Men Out. He died in 2008. And on this day in 1955, 58 years ago, the birth of actress Deborah Winger in Columbus, Ohio, urban cowboy, an officer and a gentleman, terms of endearment, a dangerous woman. One more while we recall Golden Boy, the Rat Pack, and Ocean's 11. On this day in 1990, 23 years ago, the death of entertainer Sammy Davis Jr. at age 65 from cancer. His career began at age 3, and though he had never acknowledged it, he was part Cuban. He lost his left eye in a 1954 auto accident. Yes, I can. We leave with a thought from Studs Terkel, who never used his law degree from the University of Chicago. Quote, "You happen to be talking to an agnostic. You know what an agnostic is? A cowardly atheist." Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is